Case number SCWC 28958, C. Brewer & Company Limited versus James River Insurance Company et al. Arguing for the petitioner, Robert J. Romero. Also appearing for the petitioner, Keith Hirooka and Jody Roca. Arguing for the respondent, Kenneth Kupchak. Also appearing for the respondent, Tread Ireley. And appearing on behalf of the State of Hawaii, Reese Nakamura. Argument on the merits.
Before we commence with argument, we'll take up the motion that was filed on Monday. The court has considered the motion. We will not hear arguments on the motion, and the motion is denied. You may start your or and the arguments must confine themselves to the record on appeal. Counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Robert Romero, with Hinshaw & Culbertson on behalf of James River Insurance Company. I'm here with my friend and colleague, Keith Hirooka. I thank the court, first of all, for allowing me to appear in your courtroom. Your Honor, this is a very important case to James River Insurance Company. I've lived with this case since 2007 when I argued it before Judge Watanabe in Kauai. This case, as the court knows, arises out of the Kailoko Dam disaster in March of 2006. What I'd like to cover this morning relates to our petition for certiorari. It relates to an insurance coverage dispute, which, as this court knows, is a contract. And as a contract, the Hawaii courts, the Supreme Court, has enunciated rules of contract interpretation. And insurance policies should not be governed by desires that are divorced from the contract. This is an insurance contract that arises out of a very unique set of circumstances. This is a contract that was negotiated by sophisticated parties. It was a contract that arose out of unique events.
And are we already getting off the terms of the contract and you're telling us about circumstances that surround the formation? I thought we were interpreting what's on the face of the contract.
Yes, Justice, that's correct. We are interpreting the contract. The specific reason we're here today is that C. Brewer bought a specific contract of insurance.
Was this the claims-made policy?
Pardon me?
Was this a claims-made policy?
A claims-made policy is a policy different than the policy at issue here.
This policy is on a claims-made and reported basis. Is this a claims-made policy?
No, it was not, Your Honor.
Why not?
The policy was a comprehensive general liability policy, which is indicated by this CG.
Why does it say it's on a claims-made basis?
The declarations page says that, but when you read the contract as a whole, you see quite clearly that the contract that was issued was a commercial general liability policy, a CGL policy. The reason we're here is—
Are you saying that it's an occurrence policy? I'm very confused.
Your Honor, it is an occurrence policy with respect to bodily injury and property damage. It is an occurrence policy, and the reason we know that is the CGL form that was impacted by the endorsement, and that, Justice, is what we're speaking about. It started as a general liability form, but it was negotiated to a specific limited type of coverage. The endorsement, which modifies the CGL policy, contained a limitation of coverage to designated premises. That limitation of coverage to designated premises identified 311 Pacific, which C. Brewer leased. It identified a couple of other buildings, and it identified vacant land. It did not identify the Kailoko Dam or anything to do with the irrigation system. The important part of this contract is it was limited in nature. And
how would advertising liability arise in those premises?
Advertising injury, Justice McKenna, is an entirely different type of coverage. Advertising injury coverage is what we call offense-based coverage. So, for example.
So, are you saying, but I thought that the limitation applied to both coverages, bodily coverage A and coverage B.
It does, Your Honor. It does, Justice. It applies to bodily injury, property damage, and advertising injury. However, the advertising injury, bodily injury, or property damage has to be tied to the identified schedule properties.
Right.
That's what C. Brewer bought.
So the question is then, how would personal and advertising injury be tied to those premises? Because obviously the injury would not occur in the premises, correct?
Correct, but that's why my response to your earlier question, Justice McKenna, is so important. It's a different trigger. Under Sentinel, that this court issued, bodily injury and property damage is an occurrence, injury in fact, dam breaks. Personal injury is different. Let me give you an example of when personal injury would apply to C. Brewer in this
case. Can you
case.
Tell me where in this policy it says that this becomes an occurrence policy rather than a claims-made policy as is stated on the declarations page?
Your Honor, the actual policy form, and the policy's in the record, obviously. Policy form, the commercial general liability declarations, and it has various forms and endorsements to it. This is a part of the policy. It's a commercial general liability coverage form. This tells the insurer.
Where is it on the record on appeal?
Pardon me?
Where is it on the record on appeal?
This is contained as a citation, Exhibit 1, to our motion for summary judgment that was filed in the trial court, Exhibit 1. So to answer your question, Justice McKenna, this is the commercial general liability form. This, in this policy, it contains bodily injury, property damage coverage. It also contains advertising injury coverage. The reason we're here is this policy form was changed by endorsement. And that endorsement talks about the limitation of coverage to designated premises. That provision reads, this insurance applies to bodily injury, property damage, or personal and advertising injury arising out of the ownership, maintenance, or use of the premises shown in the above schedule.
Does it limit it to the premises that are covered? Does it say that the injury has to occur on the premises?
It does by its very terms, Your Honor, Justice.
And then how does personal and advertising injury then occur on the premises? Isn't this nonsensical,
No, it's not, Your Justice, with all due respect. Personal injury, I'll give you an example. For example, 311 Pacific Street is a scheduled location. When you look at the CGL form, personal and advertising injury is offense-based. It's not an accident, it's offense-based. For example, when you read the definition of personal and advertising injury, the first thing they talk about is false imprisonment. False imprisonment. So for example, if someone goes to 311 Pacific, which is a scheduled location, and someone is kept there without their consent, and C. Brewer is sued, there's coverage for that. That is a covered personal injury offense that's tied to the scheduled location. One of the things, if the court will indulge me, is when the facts of this case are important, because as I said at the outset, this is a negotiated policy between sophisticated parties. C. Brewer, which was a conglomerate in this state that goes back several decades, came to James River, came to my client and said, we're getting out of, we're winding down, we're selling everything. And before we became on the risk, before our policy incepted in December 2005, we're out of this business. We're out of this. We want limited coverage. And the reason that that's important, Justice, is it's not to go far afield, it's to say that this court should give meaning and effect to the limitation of coverage to designated premises.
So why did you issue them a commercial general liability insurance contract?
Your
if you Honor, wanted it, so, it sounds to me like you're trying to convert this contract from one thing to something else.
Your Honor, it was converted at the outset. It was converted by this endorsement.
Okay, so what you're arguing to us is suddenly we're going from a general liability to a premise liability. You don't change the title. The contract is titled Commercial General Liability, and then we have this one-page limitation of coverage, and then right below it it says the endorsement modifies the following commercial, why didn't you just get rid of the title? Why didn't you just say, hey, this is a premise liability. This contract, even though it's titled one thing, means something completely different. That's your argument.
Your Honor, with all due respect, the endorsement and the rules that this court applies to contract interpretation dictate that the contract is to be interpreted as a whole and that each term will modify the other and to give plain meaning, and common speech is the phrase that the courts talk about, common speech.
You know, the limitation does not say this insurance applies only to bodily injury, property damage occurring on these premises. Your coverage says it covers bodily injury or property damage that takes place in the coverage territory, which includes the entire state of Hawaii.
The limitation of coverage to designated premises does, in fact, limit coverage to the designated premises. This is a very common endorsement. An endorsement, by definition, amends
the
policy.
Is it that clear? It says use of. It says use of. It doesn't say occurring within. Use of the premises. What if you use the premises, and what if you were using the premises and you were lifting something and the crane fell and landed on the next property, okay? It didn't occur within the premises, or it lands on somebody across the street. It doesn't occur within the premises, and you're saying there's no coverage because it only covers injuries on the premises.
It covers occurrences that are linked to the designated premises.
How
so, for example, a slip and fall on a designated premises, there's a potential for coverage for that. But when you have a situation like this, where
what is like this? Where is that line then? Use of. How do you define it? Because I don't see a definition.
The use, what I would suggest is that the use is the physical use of the property.
Why does it say the physical use of the property? Is that what your limitation says?
Our limitation speaks for itself. It says what it says, and when you give meaning and effect to it, which other courts have, granted there's no Hawaii case on point, but the courts that have looked at this very language very recently, and these are cited in the petition, they include two cases that are more recent, the Pekin Insurance Company case versus Reoccurrent Training Center.
I thought that case was criticized.
Pardon me?
Was that case recently criticized? That's what you're... The other side is saying that case is recently criticized.
Not to the points that we're citing it for, Your Honor. The point in that case is that when you have a limitation of coverage to designated premises, the concept of use cannot be as expansive as your question implies.
You know, one of the things you started out with, you said, you know, these are sophisticated entities. And what I can't understand is there's cases going back into the 90s where the courts have been wrestling with this stuff. It has been so easy. If that's what you wanted to do, this is from 2005. Why couldn't you folks have written it in a way so it wasn't so ambiguous? It was very, very clear. The onus is on you. When you write a contract, that's what the law says.
This is a contract that was negotiated by both parties, and it was a contract, Justice, that says what it says. It limits it to the designated premises. And what we're dealing with here is a dam break that occurs obviously out of that premises, and a dam break that is completely divorced of anything that Seabrewer is doing. It takes the concept of use beyond which I think is fair. I think Justice Watanabe, when she said that, I think she said, the court finds, which is quote, the court finds that the arguments by Seabrewer regarding the use of theory exceeds the bounds of the plain and ordinary meaning of the policy. We believe that's correct. And when you apply the rules of contract interpretation.
That's actually a conclusion of law, is it? Not a finding of fact.
That's the conclusion of law based on well over an hour of argument that she came away with, and we believe it was correct.
Mr. Romero, could I just interrupt you for a second, follow up on something that Justice Pollack asked about in terms of the case law? Because I understand your proposition that Justice Watanabe or Judge Watanabe recognized that there was a negotiation taking place that negotiated the commercial general liability to a more specific policy with a designated premises endorsement. But that set of facts, and you made the point about how this really depends on the facts in this case, but that set of facts seems to have been analyzed in large part in the American Guarantee case by the Fifth Circuit, and I'm sure you've spent some time taking a look at that, but there was a designated premises endorsement, and it was a general commercial general liability policy, and the court found that there was a causal connection between what happened in the designated premises and another premises, right? The premises that was being used by the son of the CEO, I guess, who was engaging in conduct that created liability on a different premises, not included in the designated premises endorsement. And there the court found that a jury, I guess, could find that there was a causal connection between the decisions made at the headquarters and what happened at this non-designated premises. So why wouldn't that apply in this case with the understanding, as you said, that this depends on the facts and maybe there needs to be a fact-finding rather than a determination by a summary judgment?
Excellent question. I agree that there ultimately may be a necessary fact-finding determination. The American Guarantee case is a case, indeed, I've spent a lot of time on. The American Guarantee case, I believe, in some aspects, supports our position. The American Guarantee case did involve a son who wanted to open a photography studio. His father was the head of Coca-Cola bottling. And in that case, unlike this case, you had the designated premises, the Coca-Cola headquarters, being is really one and the same as of the photography studio because it was a division of Coca-Cola. It had the same employees.
Was it on the same premises?
Pardon?
Was it on the same premises?
No, it wasn't, Justice. It was not on the same premises. But the notion of use in that case, the causal connection, I could see where the court made that conclusion. One thing that that particular American Guarantee did, which still hasn't been addressed by any court, is in that case you'll recall that the limitation of coverage to designated premises, and this is an important point, had a qualifying language at the end. And in fact, every single case that I believe I've read before this court has this qualifying clause that was involved in the case there, in American Guarantee. And it was part of the reason the court could conclude that there was a causal connection. The James River policy reads as follows. This insurance applies only to bodily injury, property damage, or personal injury arising out of the ownership, maintenance, or use of the premises shown in the above schedule, period. That's where it ends. The American Guarantee case, all of these other cases that we talk about include the following language. And operations necessary or incidental to those premises. I suggest to you that that is expansive language. You look at American Guarantee, it says, okay, we're going to find the causal connection, but then they'll say, at the very least, it's operations necessary or incidental to those premises. That language isn't in.
That's an and.
And.
It's either.
Pardon me?
It's either. It's, in other words, it applies to both of those situations.
Right.
It applies both to arising out of and operations incidental.
Correct.
Which I actually think is more limiting. Incidental, that has to be tied up to exactly to the...
At the end of the day, I think it's a distinction without a difference, because I think under either language, the cases that show that you have to look at what happened at the designated premises controls.
Okay, so, you know, I seem to be harping on this issue, but it says the insurance applies only, not only to bodily injury property, but personal and advertising injury arising out of the ownership, maintenance, or use of the premises. And you say the first definition of personal and advertising injury is false arrest, detention, or imprisonment, which conceivably could occur within the premises. But the second offense included in that category is malicious prosecution. So how does a malicious prosecution occur within your premises?
Because a malicious prosecution action is still can be related to the ownership, maintenance, or use of a
particular
property.
Well, how does it occur within the premises?
Well, in a hypothetical situation, I decide to sue someone without probable cause and with malice.
The suit is filed in the court.
That's correct.
not your premises.
But
the decision to do it may be made within the premises.
Justice McKenna, it gets back to what the trigger of coverage is. For bodily injury and property damage, we're talking about bang, an accident. Okay, it's defined in the CGL for policy form, which I held up earlier. Personal injury and advertising injury coverage is an offense-based coverage. And in the case that we cite, Founders versus Trinity Insurance, in that case, there
well,
was...
Well, personal and advertising injury includes consequential bodily injury, so it apparently includes perhaps, you know, physical manifestations of stress or whatever that might arise out of the personal and advertising injury.
Certainly there's damage when someone's defamed or someone is falsely imprisoned. That's not the point. The point is the trigger of coverage for advertising injury is the occurrence or the happening of the enumerated offense, the slander, the false imprisonment.
But it doesn't occur within the premises. And I don't understand why you think you could restrict bodily injury coverage to something that occurs on the premises, yet it's the same limitation that applies to personal and advertising.
I would respectfully point the court to the Founders versus Trinity case, Trinity Insurance case. That's a case that involved a limitation of coverage to designated premises. And hopefully, Justice McKenna, this would resolve some of the questions that you and the other members of the court may have. In Founders versus Trinity, we had a limitation of coverage to designated premises. And in that case, the scheduled property was vacant land. We insured vacant land. Well, the owner of that property built a healthcare living facility on part of that vacant land. And in that case, the insurer, the policyholder, was sued for trademark because their life care facility, they called a certain name, and somebody else came out and said, hey, wait a minute, that's our name. We're going to sue you for trademark infringement. And in that case, the court did give meaning and effect to this limitation of coverage to designated premises in an advertising injury context. And considering the territory provision arguments that was in one of your questions. So the point of that case and the reason we cited...
Was it exactly the same policy?
For all intents and purposes, it was, although...
Did it have this infringing upon another person, another trade dress or slogan in advertising?
Yes, because that court did what we did in this case.
Which court was that?
If you give me 1 minute, I will.
Was that a duty to defend case or was that a duty to indemnify?
Duty to defend case, Your Honor.
And I'm not quite sure about the other states, but you are aware that our duty to defend law is pretty broad.
I'm keenly aware of that, and I practice primarily in California. And the potentiality standard is the standard that I understood when I argued at the trial court level. Any possibility of coverage, any potential of coverage is going to carry the day. And we embrace that standard. We believe that at the trial court level that we proved that there's an impossibility of coverage because this policy was a very different kind of policy. When something happened in 2007 before I argued the summary judgment motion to Judge Wattenheim, 7 months before then, C. Brewer filed a motion for summary, partial motion for summary judgment against the other 16 carriers who did issue broad comprehensive coverage. Right? We weren't part of that motion. They didn't seek coverage. And more importantly, and this is important because it's referenced in the ICA opinion, when counsel's colleagues argued that motion, and I won't quote it here, you can see it in the record, it's very telling. I remember Mr. Hiraoka coming back and we discussed it. He was there, I wasn't, but I read it since. It said, we were out of this damn business. We wanted an entirely different kind of policy. We got an entirely different kind of policy. That's why James River is not here.
So once again, we're relying on what someone said rather than what is in the contract. When I read that argument, I go, they must not be comfortable with what's in the contract because they're trying to argue something's a judicial admission, which seems to me that will go, and it may be relevant when if there's an ambiguity and it has to go to the intent of the parties, but that was my reaction to the argument.
And Your Honor, that's a perfectly appropriate reaction, and I'd have the same reaction, but as an advocate on behalf of my client, I think it does the following. First of all, I'm saying that I'm not asking you to do anything but other than apply the rules of contract interpretation, those pillars of, you know, give everything its meaning and economy and effect, and not find an ambiguity where there is none. But that comment is an acknowledgement that our interpretation is correct. I agree that the ICA footnoted that as a reason to send it back if there's further dispute, and I think that's perfectly appropriate. And under Hawaii law. But we're not asking for the ruling to go in our favor because that's some type of judicial admission. It could be. We're not saying that. What we're saying precisely is that when you apply the rules of contract interpretation, that the limitation of coverage to designated premises means something. It would be rewriting it out of the policy to find coverage for something so remote as that we're dealing with.
You use the word arising, and you cited the case where they gave a definition of arising, and it couldn't have been broader. The American Guarantee, doesn't it say arising means originating, having its origin in, growing out, flowing from? That's the case you're pointing us to, and that's the definition of arising out.
That's the case that they rely on, which we've distinguished. I've talked about that.
You said
arising out of is a generally a broad term. That's clear. However, it's not unlimited. And to characterize the use of 311 Pacific to say that somehow that's an occurrence, that the Coloco Dam, which is an injury, in fact, occurrence that did happen, somehow can be shoehorned in this policy, is a rewrite of this policy. The Haitian refugee case, which we also cite, is the case that I think is the proper legal analysis of what occurs here. In Haitian refugee, you had a situation where this nonprofit organizes a march 1 mile away from the headquarters. And the headquarters is essentially 311 Pacific in our case. That's the headquarters. The march takes place 1 mile away and somebody gets shot. In that case, the policyholder says, well, wait a minute. Our headquarters was a scheduled location. We made a decision not to hire security here. They're saying we did or didn't do something here on property that we never owned. Same kind of argument. In the Haitian refugee case, the court had a very easy time of saying, well, that is going to distort the arising out of use factor to the point this is going to cover all business operations, and that is precisely the type of judicial rewrite we won't engage in. That's what that case say, and that is the type of situation that we believe we're in. This limitation, based on the rules of contract interpretation, have to be given meaning and effect. They have to be given meaning and effect because the rules of contract interpretation cannot be so applied in an undisciplined manner that simply because you want coverage or you say that this means something different can carry the day. The cases that this court has pointed us to certain pillars of contract interpretation, not finding an ambiguity where there is none, giving policies meaning and effect, looking at the entire document, which some of the questions of Justin McKenna, the differences between coverage A, bodily injury, property damage, and coverage B, which we talk about, personal injury and advertising injury, different coverages, the CGL and the notion of an endorsement. It's an amendment.
Were you defending under a reservation of rights?
No, Your Honor, we weren't. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Unless there's any questions, I'd like to save some time.
Justice Fowler, did you want
to? No, go ahead. All right. You can reserve.
Thank you. I'll be back to respond briefly. Thank you.
Chuck, I represent C. Brewer, the appellee, and the insured. There has been and continues to be only one question on this appeal, and that's the interpretation of the designated premises policy. It's at its simplest, I say this turns on the interplay of three cases, two of which have been discussed by Mr. Romero. It's important in this context to see that this policy was issued in 2005. which is 2 years after the case that Mr. Romero relies on, Haitian refugee, was decided. The Haitian refugee case was decided 6 years after the American guarantee case. And these two cases establish the legal ambiguity that the ICA relied upon in its decision. Although the James River policy confirms in bold-face letters, as acknowledged several times by Mr. Romero, that it is a commercial general liability policy, James River asked this court to convert it into an owner-landlord-tenant premises policy. This argument was rejected by the American guarantee case. And in the third case that we believe is important here, which is the American Enterprise versus Shabab House case. And I'll quote that case. For such an ambitious undertaking, the conversion of a general liability policy to a premises liability policy, the designated premises endorsement must be clear and unequivocal. Although all three of these policies contain a phrase, as indicated by Mr. Romero, that the use of the property must be necessary incidentally related to the premises, they each came out with a different reading of that language. The Haitian refugee case focused on being incidental to the building or the premises. The American guarantee case focused on it being incidental to the use of the building. On the other hand, Shabab House, as our ICA, recognized as both of these readings might be possible, the endorsement was ambiguous and thus gave the benefit to the insured and extended coverage. What's so fascinating about the Shabab House case is that it's a federal district court interpreting under Erie Florida law. And the Haitian case is a Florida intermediate court case, but Shabab didn't follow it.
Different district?
The Shabab case is the federal district.
Right, so was it a different district in Florida so that it wouldn't have been?
In Erie, you follow the state law.
Right.
All right, and it's the Florida Intermediate Court of Appeals decision that's in play in the Haitian case.
Right.
So on first instance, you'd suspect that Shabab would be required to follow that interpretation. But in fact, it says that we think that if Shabab House knew of the two provisions which you have called our attention today, it would have come to a different conclusion. These are the advertising injury provision and the territorial coverage definition.
Mr. Kupchak?
Both of these suggest that there's coverage beyond the walls of the premises. Shabab says that Florida itself would likewise have found coverage.
Mr. Kupchak, does your interpretation do what Mr. Romero is arguing about, and that is write out the limitations to designated premises?
I was just going to go to the rules of interpretation which preclude us from writing out a term. And what he's trying to do is write out the territorial coverage term, and he's trying to convert the policy. As Shabab says, if you want to convert the policy, you have to say specifically that you're doing that in the designated premises provision. It has to be unequivocal. And even if there were no legal ambiguity, which under Sentinel, the Sentinel case was real big in the opinions below, it says that if you have two, there's no case of first instance here. This is a case of first instance, and that was admitted. And there is a dispute in interpreting that language or something like that in other jurisdictions. We have a legal ambiguity which requires us to find in favor of the insured. That's the Sentinel case. And that's essentially what the ICA was doing below. Since we can read it both ways, we'll give you a chance to go back and look at that ambiguity. Now,
are you arguing that there is a duty to defend?
Yes, absolutely.
But you did not appeal. You did not file an application for cert to this court because the ICA was ruling that there are questions of fact, that both interpretations are reasonable. So therefore, or there are questions of fact as to whether or not it arises out of did the ICA actually find a duty to defend?
The ICA said that we think this is ambiguous. Let's go look at the intent of the policy.
Right, and remand it to the trial court.
And if the insurer isn't able to establish its holding on the intent, burden of proof being against it, we win. That's how I understand the ICA case.
But the ICA did not say that based on the ambiguity there's a duty to defend.
It did not. I think they were wrong.
But you did not file an application.
That's correct, because we think we're going to win on the next one, and they can't prove that there's any intent difference in it. If they had somebody, they would have put as a declaration on top of the papers that they filed. This was negotiated, the extent it was negotiated in 2005. I can't believe that they're going to find anybody that's going to say, particularly C. Brewer, that we understood that we weren't going to be covered for our management decisions in our office. It just didn't really happen. But that's for the remand on it. So I want to get back and say this particular one, because it does not have the incidental or necessary tie to the premises, is even a stronger case. As Justice Pollack pointed out, the suggestion that that language would be more expansive than not having it at all is just silly, and it falls by its own weight. If we look at the language of this provision, it's on the provision is only 30 words in the policy. It's in volume 20, I think it begins at 352 of the record policy, and it's on the 24th page of that policy. It's unconditional. It just reads simply that it covers injuries arising out of the use of Seabrewer's office. I'd like to repeat that again. There are no conditions on the triggering use. James River argues, as we said, that's less expansive. I just think that makes no sense. And Shabab House itself, as I said, must make it clear. It says it must make it clear that this thing is premises. As I say, they issued this policy in 2005, which was after the Haitian refugee case. So assuming they're a sophisticated insurer, they knew about that case. They could have availed itself of that language had they wanted to take advantage of that argument. They chose not to do that, and therefore the Haitian case is just not applicable here. C. Brewer submits that no reasonable policyholder, and it's from our perspective that you have to read this policy, would understand that despite the coverage's advertising industry injuries, the unconditional use reference and the expansive coverage territory definition, that it had no coverage. It's just beyond belief. Shabab House concluded that this was unbelievable as well. Thus, at the end of the day, this case is simply about whether there are any underlying allegations about the use of the office that caused these damages. All of the underlying plaintiffs have alleged management and negligent decision-making at Brewer's headquarters, the designated premises, and it contributed to their injuries. To defeat a duty to defend, James River has to establish it would be impossible for any of the underlying plaintiffs to prove any causal connection between C. Brewer's use of the office and their injuries. James River apparently not happy with the fact that its standalone unconditional endorsement doesn't cover this problem. Ask you to look somewhere else in the policy. It asks you to ignore the territorial coverage. And it, even though it has only one issue on this appeal, the interpretation of this endorsement, it asks you to look at another endorsement and two exclusions as interpretive aids as opposed to applying them. It didn't ask you to consider applying them. This ploy also was rejected in Shabab House. And quote, the abuse and molestation is self-evident within American Empire's policy. In defining its meaning, does not require reading any other provision. Hawaii law requires that you read coverage broadly, but that you read limitations on coverage strictly. Furthermore, as James River, the insurer, has the burden to establish exclusions, they certainly can't be used as interpretive aids. Let's take a look, however, at the classification limitation. It does not purport to amend the designated premises language. James River admits it's a standalone provision.
It talks about activities, doesn't it? Activities and operations.
It's limited strictly to operations. There's absolutely nothing about the location of damages on it. It's not... It either applies on its own or it does not. But it's not an interpretive aid to the designated premises endorsement. This question was not addressed by the circuit court, and thus Seabrewer did not appeal it to the ICA. And James River only asked you to look at the endorsement for designated premises. But it appears on page 28 of the policy. That's page 780 of the record, volume 20. It's 2.5 lines and 37 words. That's a standalone provision. Neither this endorsement nor the declaration suggests that the policy's CGL coverage is being converted to an owner-landlord-tenant premises policy. This endorsement, as we said, addresses only operations. Nor is there any suggestion that the classification limitation endorsement restricts the location, as I mentioned. Seabrewer is directed to look at two disjunctive locations within the declaration to find out what type of operations are involved. One of these classifications actually exists and it shows up on page 2 of the declaration, which is page 753 of the record, where the classification section lists unconditionally office, also lists the warehouse and vacant land. Each arguably suggests a different type of operation that might be insured. James River, ignoring the office reference, focuses on another specified provision of the declaration, description of operations. But there is no such provision in the declaration. And James River suggests we have to look at description of business, which might be helpful. And under this section, it says real estate owners. This term is not defined. And as a result, Seabrewer should be entitled to all doubt encompassing anything that might possibly be involved in activities involving real estate.
Doesn't the very next state page say, it says real estate owners, and then on the next page it says, all premises you own, rent, or occupy.
Absolutely. There's no distinction as to what is being owned in terms of type of policy. You can own an easement. You can own a lessee's interest. There are different interests in real property, real estate owner operations. It doesn't define it, so I think we're entitled to it cover all uses of real estate. And if we look at the operations, it's not confined to time either, the broad definition. And as we've attempted to say in our briefs below,
they don't own the land their offices on, do they?
They don't exist anymore.
Well, I mean,
but at the time, they were using what was Brewer Environmental Industries' office building, but they'd sold that office building, so they were renting it as their office. The office is specifically listed on the classification section, which stands on its own as well as the real estate operation. It's an independent reason for coverage because the endorsement itself uses the disjunctive off or. It says the classification says office. So this was our office. It's admitted to be our office. The extent that real estate owners' operations are involved, we've been in this real estate business since the 1890s or before, apparently, according to the allegations. Apparently had lands in Kilauea, or Kilauea Sugar Plantation, which went out of business in the 70s. And we tried to redevelop that to make more return on that land, and the state decided to condemn it to leverage us in such a way. And as a result of that, there was an agreement reached, which was recorded which required us to develop the lands in a certain way. And I'm suggesting that the allegations probably encompass the fact that duties came coming arising out of this publicly undertaking of duties by the state and Brewer run to each of the plaintiffs below, and they're saying they generated continuous duties to warn and notify on it. It's hard to imagine that any of these allegations do not relate to a real estate operation. We've listed many of them on footnote 3 of our reply brief, and goes through the allegations back and forth. But none of them are excluded by this.
I'm really just looking at the policies. I'm even more confused now. The policy says, on page 2 of the declaration, it says location number all premises you own, rent, or occupy.
Yes.
And it says address of all premises you own, rent, or occupy. See attached IL1201. Right. And the 1201 includes Pacific Street,
yep,
Kahualii, and then Old Mamalahue Highway, and a bunch of vacant lots, right?
Yep, that's on page 797 of the record.
Okay. And then the designated premises endorsement or limitation of coverage to designated premises says applies only to the ownership, maintenance, or use of the premises shown in the above schedule. And the schedule says premises locations 1 to 3.
Right.
So what is that?
Okay. Well, I said we get the benefit of the ambiguity, but at least seems to cover the three that are listed on page 2 of the declaration.
So is this supposedly now writing out everything, all the vacant land?
I say no.
But does it purport to on its face? It says it's limited. If you follow James River's argument,
Yeah. Wouldn't
it just be limited to the first three now and everything else that's on the, even though the deck sheet says all premises you own or occupy, and you look at all these locations, including all of these parcels of vacant land, they're saying that they've written those out. Wouldn't that be the logic of the argument?
I'm not sure what the logic of their argument is, but there are at least two ways to read what the coverage is. One of them is that you first go to page 2 of the declaration under classification, and there are three listings.
Right.
Those could be the locations. If you notice, there's location number, classifications. Vacant land is one of those three. Building or premises, office is the second, and warehouse the third. Okay? So arguably, it's everything there. Those are the three. Another way to look at it is to look at that location thing in the back, which lists hundreds of properties, and you take the first three of those. Regardless, the office is one of them. And all these allegations that we're saying that give rise to the defense, at a minimum, rise out of the office. It's the use of the office.
What is locations 1 to 3 on the DPE? I'm confused.
You're talking about the declaration itself?
No, the limitation of coverage. What is locations 1 to 3?
Okay, and I'm saying...
It's not clearly defined, in other words.
I absolutely agree that it's ambiguous. But the ambiguity is still in our direction. We get the benefit of it. However you read it, the offices are covered.
Okay, so under the declarations, which part is the...
Page 2.
Is it it's the building? Is it the... Under page 2 of the declarations, mm-hmm, which one would be 311 Pacific?
It would be the office.
Where does it say office?
It says that in the under classification, second category of locations, building and premises dash office.
Office, okay, so that's where it would be. Yeah. So the premium for that was $525.
That's right. So we entitled some kind of insurance.
If limitation to designated premises denominates locations 1 through 3,
yeah,
I understand that the declaration has three locations, but nothing is denominated locations 1 through 3. Is there another reference somewhere?
Taking this to its illogical conclusion, if they didn't have any locations identified,
well, true enough,
this endorsement doesn't apply.
Okay, but
I win again.
Yeah. I understand there are three locations.
This was a sloppy drafted an insurance policy that you're going to come up to. I mean, as we pointed out, the provisions that say referrals to, there's nothing in that title. So we have to hunt and find something else. And if you look at the Shabab House, it says, if you have to go to here, to there to find something else, that's ambiguous per se.
Okay, so then I just have a question. In terms of the schedule of locations toward the end with all of, you know, Pacific, Kalmari, and Oma Malawi. All right, so Pacific would be the second one you're saying on the declarations. Which one is a warehouse?
Warehouse is the third one there.
Mamalohe. And then...
Oh, well, you're going to the page 757. I believe that's...
Well, see, I'm looking at the original motion. I'm looking at the policy attached to the original motion, so your page numbering isn't helping me.
Well, does it have an A number at the bottom, too?
Yes, In A2096,
yeah,
right?
That's also page 796 in the record on volume 20.
Okay, well, we have it as, anyway, 2096. Okay, so Pacific Street, it would be the building or premises, correct? Which one is the Kaumualii?
I believe that's the warehouse, but I don't know. I'm guessing.
Where's Mamalohoi on the Hoa?
That's on the Big Island. It's Popeye Cove.
Is that on the deck sheet?
I don't know. I didn't make that comparison. That may be one of the vacant lands.
This is very confusing. This is a change? When was this? No, this is December 15th, right?
December 5th, 2005. While we're looking at the policy, you raised the question about coverage B. Coverage B is specific, the ongoing irrigation limitation specifically only applies to coverage A by its own terms. So coverage B is still alive, and we know coverage B exists under designated premises because it says advertising injury is one of the things it's covered. Now, Mr. Romero tries to make some point about whether it's an occurrence or an offense. It doesn't really matter. The offenses are listed on page, if you still have that there, A02067. Paragraph 14C, wrongful eviction from, wrongful entry into, invasion of the right of private occupancy, etc. This floodwater certainly did that. Even constructive eviction has been interpreted to be under that. So arguably, among the many causes of action, these plaintiffs may come in and say, we think this is what you did to us, and we need a defense against that. And it's under coverage B on it.
You didn't argue that below, right?
He's the one who brought up this exception, which is B.
But when you filed your motion for partial summary judgment, on James River's duty to defend, I didn't see that argument. Right?
We did not raise that at that point. But we're here on James River's point, and they're trying to make the point that the ongoing operation is somehow should be read on what is in designated premises.
Well, but basically you're saying as looking at the policy, there are different ways in which a duty to defend might.
And they have to defend unless they exclude all possible claims on it. And let's assume one of these exceptions does apply to some cause. They've got to get rid of all the causes on it. And we've got Pfluger filling in the spillway. We've got rusted gates. We've got the topping of the dam. These things may or may not fall into any of these things. And the coverage B is in play. And they've got to show up. If any of these things hit, they've got to show up. But it's not my job to prove that exclusions don't apply. They have to prove that they do and that they exclude everything. And they haven't even attempted to do that on this record. So we argue that the ICA got it right, even though we'd like them to say that they have a duty to defend. They did say that the policy was ambiguous, which we've proved in spades today, and therefore they cannot be dismissed from the case, and the ICA should be affirmed. Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Romero have?
He has 1 minute and 41 seconds.
All right.
First of all, Justice, the citation was the Founders Trinity Universal. This is the advertising injury case. It's a Houston, that's a Court of Appeal Texas case, 176 Southwest 3rd, 484. The policy changes, your question did the correct thing, which is to interpret the policy as a whole. You end up at the policy changes form, which lists the three premises. You talked about the
There's
other...
Not, I don't see three premises. I mean, I see more than three. I see three addresses and then a bunch of vacant parcels.
But to read the policy as a whole, as this court is expected to do, it says the location list should also include the following locations of vacant land to be identified by their TMK numbers as follows. Right. There's no ambiguity.
So can you compare that page to the declarations page two? And the three parcels that are the first three addresses listed, where are they on the declarations page?
The declarations page refers to this page to identify, and it does identify. You have to read the entire policy as a whole.
Sorry, the declarations page refers to that? I thought it was your DPE that refers to
the schedule locations, yes, refers to that page, correct. The schedule locations on the limitation coverage.
Okay.
When you read the policy as a whole, there's no doubt what we're talking about is the schedule location. The classification endorsement talks about real estate owners. They never own 311 Pacific. When we were at the trial court, we got a declaration that showed that that was a leasehold interest. Now, the ICA didn't pick up on that, but we argued that.
Does that help you when you're trying to argue that this is only applies to rental owners? Real estate owners, if they don't own
it,
that
it
was
does,
my question.
Does. Yes, Your Honor, it does help us in two respects. First of all, they never own the dam. We only insured C. Brewer Limited, not these subsidiaries who are responsible for that. The fact is, the real estate classification informs the meaning of the limitation of coverage.
No, my question is, are you acknowledging that you were insuring 311, that location? Because they didn't own it, they didn't own the land.
It's one of the additional factors that tell us there's no potential for coverage here. That was not an owned property.
Wait a minute. So did you argue that below, that it's rented, so therefore...
We did. We had a declaration that showed that it was a leasehold interest. Now, they were arguing at the trial court level, well, that's ambiguous. Go to any person on the street and say, do you rent or own your home?
So now you're saying the coverage is limited to property, only property that they own. Is that right?
Right. When you review this policy,
then why does your policy say all premises you own, rent, or occupy? Why does it say that at the top? Why would you even include that language on the declarations page?
Because again, we're talking about an endorsement to a policy. An endorsement is an amendment to a contract. When you talk about our limitation of coverage to designated premises, it modifies the contract.
But the policy changes schedule location, says 311 Pacific.
It does. It does. And at the time, we didn't know what the status was, but we learned when we were sued in a case seeking coverage, we found out in Rule 56 motion justice that they didn't own that property. Here, and one last thing, since they have very limited time. $525 is what they got for that 311 property. One of the things I learned in law school is that sometimes public policy does matter. C. Brewer is a huge company. The dam break was a catastrophe for this state and everybody impacted. When an insurance company comes into the state of Hawaii, it's a good thing to have predictability. It's a good thing that the court's going to apply the rules that they've enunciated with some discipline. It's a bad thing when companies like C. Brewer, who have some connection to a dam, cut corners and say, you know what, We want a different kind of policy. We'll pay you $525 for that. What they should have done is gone out and got correct coverage that would have protected the people.
Mr. Rivera, I'm so sorry, but this is really starting to bother me. Okay, so now you're saying that there's no coverage because they didn't own it. So tell me, limitation of coverage to designated premises, your DPE, premises, locations 1-2-1-3. What are those locations?
Those locations are what are listed in the schedule that we've talked about. The reason there's no coverage is that the limitation of coverage to designated premises is not met. Nothing they did at 311 caused the dam to break.
Wait. So is 311 one of those locations?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But you're saying they don't own it, so there's no coverage.
I'm saying that there's no coverage because of the limitation of coverage to designated premises. What I'm saying is the real estate classification, to be given some meaning and effect by this court, talks about real estate owners. When you come to an insurance company, what do? Well, we own real estate. They clearly did. They didn't own the dam or anything related to the dam, but they own these three pieces of property. They own all this vacant land. Okay, that's what we're going to cover you for. If there's an occurrence on that, we're going to cover you for it. If there's an AI coverage fee, we'll cover you for it.
Okay,
we're
so we're the
cover it for you for decisions that you make that might impact property that we don't schedule for.
All right.
To accept coverage is to torture the meaning of this contract. It's to give them
Mr. Romero, you're arguing now that because they didn't own it, it's also another exclusion, correct?
Terms are being, it's not an exclusion. It's an endorsement. It's part of the insuring agreement. It's part of the promise.
Right.
That's a significant difference.
So I'm very confused. So you're saying that it's not, there's no, 311 isn't covered?
311 is a scheduled location.
Right.
Okay. It's a scheduled location. Subject to the limitation of coverage, there would be coverage. Okay. When we were sued, we found out that they didn't own that piece of property. So to be specific, we're saying there is no potential, there is no possibility of coverage. That when you apply the facts, in this case, to this contract as a whole, and you apply the rules of contract interpretation that are clear, where you cannot find ambiguity where there is none, there's no potential, there's no possibility of coverage. That's
okay,
why Judge Watt and I got
it right. Not because they don't own it.
All right.
Is that right?
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. It informs the construction of the policy as a whole.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Romero.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take this matter under advisement.
Guys, the Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii stands adjourned.